So over the years, we've been doing this. I've had this notion that at Christmas, since, it's not exactly Jesus' birthday, but kind of, that we should talk about the Buddha in particular. So I've been doing that for years, and often talking about his disciples and all kind of different stuff. But this year I had the notion to kind of explore his life before awakening this week and his life after awakening next week, but all about what we can learn from that. It's not like a historical thing, but what we can learn from seeing what he did, the choices he made and how he navigated, because that's where it sort of gets interesting. And I will also say that some of you know I read the suttas a lot, find them just wonderful. And I have also been finding recently that AI is incredibly good at doing sutta research. So I've been able to pull up suttas that I couldn't. I mean, I knew they were there. I've read them, but I couldn't where they are. That's a whole nother question. So, and there's a real tradition of oral transmission of the sutta. I remember Ajahn Pasana, who's a very senior Western Theravada monk, we talking one time, and he said that he's read the suttas like so many. He said he's now listening to them on audio or something, and he's getting, because they were taught. You know, the Buddha originally taught them before people, and he's getting a different take. So in this context, I'm going to read some excerpts that are pretty wonderful about his life. So when you think about it, we can, in some ways, we can learn a whole lot about the path from the Buddha's life before he awakened, because most of us aren't awakened yet. Maybe some of us are, but basically we're practicing here. So we're in that same shtick that he was in of not yet awakened. So what did he do with that? Can we look at what we do? And that's interesting. After he's awakened, he's like in a whole nother realm, and it can be a little harder to relate. And also, because here in the Pacific Northwest, we're pretty privileged, just by definition. We're pretty privileged being here. And the Buddha was pretty privileged. You know, he kind of led a pretty sensory, delightful life as a young man. Surrounded, he had a royal family. It wasn't like heavy-duty royalty, but it was kind of like local royalty. This was in India 2,600 years ago, before India was a thing. So there was a bunch of different kingdoms, which at times were fighting each other. And he was from the Sakya clan, which was a sub, you know, kind of like a duke or something, a sub-royalty within the bigger Kosala kingdom, if I remember right. Yep, that is what it is. And his father wanted him, the Buddha, well, Siddhartha at that point, to continue in his footsteps, to become a hereditary leader of the clan. And even though there was some early on hints that he might be otherwise, as in a spiritual leader, that's not what his father wanted. And the Buddha describes, it's like, this is one of these things about the suttas, he describes in amazing detail what his life was like. It's like almost you couldn't make this up. He says, "Bhikkhus, I lived in refinement, utmost refinement. I had three palaces, one for the cold season, one for the hot season, and one for the rainy season. During the 4 months of the rainy season, I was entertained only by female musicians, and I did not come down from the palace. On an elephant's back or on a chariot, I used to travel around. My clothes were made of the finest Benares cloth." Benares being Varanasi now. And then in MN, this is Majjhima Nikaya 26, he said, "While I lived at home, I used to wear garments made of Kasi cloth," which is from Varanasi, "the best cloth. I used sandalwood from Kasi. My turban was made from the finest silk." So he was up there. You know, it's like living in a, can't think of the name of those neighborhoods, but the richer neighborhoods around here. And it's relevant because, you know, for all of us, one of the obstacles on the path is being distracted by pleasant stuff, by fun stuff, which is not that those are bad. But the distraction, that's bad, but it's distracting from progressing on the path. How do we work that? You know, how do we continue focused, especially on, you know, this question of awakening that is hard to see because we're not yet there in the midst of fun possibilities? How do we balance that? Not to be a Puritan about it, but how do we balance that and see what to do with it? And this is like, it's a major journey that the Buddha went through as a young person. So it's really interesting to kind of like get into his shoes, his skin a little bit, and see the choices he was making and how he navigated that, and maybe see what it might mean to us. One of the Tibetan teachings on, I'm going to start using paper. I don't have those things up there. And if I was, I know some people to teach with like nothing written down, which is so impressive. Ajahn Isabo does that. I don't know how he does it. But Tibetan teachings on bringing happiness and suffering onto the path. And they say, well, suffering, that's easy to bring onto the path. You want the suffering to stop. Or if someone else is suffering, compassion arises. But happiness, that's hard because you're already happy. So why would you think about practicing? You just want to like ride on the happiness. So it's not that, you know, I'm not saying happiness is good, but the kind of happiness that's around conditions and that is bred from circumstance, that's the one that's tricky. Because, you know, there's a whole discussion in there about dark weather. And someone just got back from Hawaii, and that's hard. So that kind of thing. And then Paulette's in synthetic Hawaii there. So, yeah. So if we're not paying attention to the Dharma, and what many people do, look at the consumer culture to try to make the conditions for happiness as much as possible and have the bad ones go away, and that's how people navigate life. And then, you know, they're caught. They're prisoners of the conditions. They can't find happiness irrespective of conditions, which is really the joy and the beauty of the Dharma. And, you know, I know it's not just me. Many of us are sort of fascinated by extremely wealthy people and how they live their lives and what they do. I mean, it's all over the internet. Maybe Google's feeding that to me because it's something I'm interested in. I don't know. But it does, you know, and also their proclivity to acquire extremely large and luxurious yachts and extremely fast and exotic cars. And I guess they're kind of happy for a while, but it's complicated. And then if someone has a downfall, it's sort of like, we're interested, you know, what does that mean? They committed themselves to that, but it didn't work out. How do we process that and bring it into our own lives? It's because, you know, maybe we would like to have a big fancy yacht if that was the our situation, although I think we want to just give the money away. But from a Dharma point of view, you know, dependence on outer circumstances is ultimately doomed. We're going to get old, we're going to get sick and die. Just in that level, it's doomed. And then stuff happens. You know, there was this, you know, in August, that big yacht, the Bayesian off the Italian coast, it was kind of like a symbolic of this, because some of you read about it, does it ring a bell to anybody? Let's see how fascinated I am or not. This is true. The internet feeds me boat stuff. I grew up around boats. So I'll just say, it's 184 feet, had the highest, tallest mast of any, probably boat in the world, 237 feet, because the previous owner had wanted it to be a sloop. And so tons of money, this exotic thing, got hit by a freak squall off the coast of Sicily and just went down and sank in about 3 minutes. Wasn't supposed to be sinkable, but it just got nailed and the owner died and the daughter died. And it just was kind of like, what an edifice that someone had created, just, you know, I don't know, $100 million, whatever it costs, some incredible amount of money to have happiness, and then it ended. Symbolic of that. So, on a subtler level, though, it is important, you know, the choices we make, how we navigate our Dharma life, how we balance it against the circle, we're lay people, you know, but how we balance it against the circumstances of circumstance, and to what degree we're really looking to awaken to be free despite conditions. And, you know, this is a thug for me, something I try to navigate. And, you know, there's happy stuff around people, what is great with friends and family and all that, but the, I think especially diversions around like sensory circumstance is something to really be mindful of, to be discerning about. And I'll, and one, and relative to that, you ever see that clothing chain, Forever 21? Forever 21, does that one ring a bell? And it's like so sad that that would be a goal and that people must, at some level, they're trying to do that when they go, very, very successful chain, I gather. So doesn't work out too well. And 25% of the women in Korea get plastic surgery. So obviously we humans have a proclivity to try to make nice circumstances to be happy. Now, what's notable about the Buddha is that he, well, we, you know, we do the best we can, but compared, we sort of do things halfway compared to how he approached things, which was kind of all the way. He was just ferocious, relentless, intense in how he approached the spiritual journey, the choices, and there's something to learn for that. And when he was young, before he took robes at 29, he had a growing sense that his life of power and pleasure was kind of a dead end. He said in MN 26, "Why, being myself subject to birth, aging, illness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to birth, aging, illness, death, sorrow, and defilement?" So he was questioning. And then he, as some of you know in the story, he left the palace to become a wandering mendicant. And it says in the suttas that he did it face to face with his parents. There's another story where he snuck out in the middle of the night, but suttas doesn't seem to say that. But right before he did that, he sort of had this moment of epiphany, and it seemed like it was at the end of some sort of palace night of debauchery. I don't know. But he's late at night, everyone's fallen asleep, and he's looking at all these people, sort of disheveled people. And he said their garlands were faded, their makeup smeared, and their clothes in disorder. Some were snoring and others were mumbling in their sleep. So it's just like the veil was lifted about whatever fancy event they were in. It was over. And something in him just said, how can you keep doing that? He's looking for something deeper. So he left, and even though his parents very much did not want him to. And he says in the suttas, later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with a blessing of youth in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So that was a big, radical choice. And the way he saw it was, amidst the many pleasures of sense, I saw danger. Likewise, in renunciation, I saw peace. Thus, I went forth. Isn't that an amazing little formula right there? You know, danger versus peace. So it's not like he was denying something. He was going toward something. And I think that's one way we can, you know, think of it in our own journey and the choices we're making is going toward. And, you know, he was just relentless in how he chose and not being diverted, because he was seeking a state of awakeness that no one around him knew about. And I think that's pretty amazing, because here, you know, in the 21st century, we need to bring some energy into our practice. And, you know, the monastics, a lot of us know, Ajahn Nisibo and Ajahn Kovalo, they're cheerful. They're happy people, and they have this relentlessness about them. And when I was in Asia, some of you know, I just came back from a pilgrimage in Asia and spent 2 weeks in monasteries in Thailand, and I could feel that there. It was pretty amazing. You know, a lot, there were some very, very dedicated lay people. There was a lot of very dedicated monastics, the Ajahns, the abbots. And you could really feel just they had dropped a whole lot of stuff just to focus on this potential for awakening. It was pretty powerful. So it's a way for us to kind of benchmark ourselves, to kind of know where we're going. But the Buddha, You know, he's a North Star. That's kind of why I read the suttas. So after he took robes, he's in these situations. It's really interesting where he trained with two great masters shortly after, because he was trying to, you know, see where to go. He trained with two great masters. You could say they were in Hindu tradition, I guess. There wasn't any Buddhist tradition. And it was because of his karma, because of something, he was incredibly good at what they taught. And the way he navigated through that, this question is really fascinating in terms of these encounters with these great masters and where he took it. Is Alara Kalama and Udaka Rama Uta. They both introduced him to basically the higher jhanas, the higher states of concentration, which are in the suttas. And some people, you know, I know some lay people who can do those, and some of us can't yet. I can't yet. Doesn't mean I won't. But the higher states of concentration, he was introduced to those, and because he was so amazing, he quickly, in both cases, attained them. In both cases, he was able to do what those great masters taught to an amazing degree from the great master's point of view. And one of them was absorption in neither perception nor non-perception, and the other was absorption in the base of nothingness. So there's a way up in the higher jhanic states. And they bring a kind of joy, even though if you just depend on that, it's defined by being able to stay in those, and you can't stay in those all the time, and you have to live. And it's not awakening. It's not the freedom of letting go that insight brings, but very high states of meditation. And he gained these, and the teachers were so impressed that both of them invited him to join them and co-lead their groups. They basically said, "Yo, dude, you got it. I'll share the reins with you. You'll have all this big sangha. You'll have a group. Work with me, you know." One of them said, "As I am, so you are. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now join this, lead this community together." I just think this is a really important moment, because when you think about it, I mean, he's just this young man. He's just 31 or something. He just left 20, 30, and he's been incredibly recognized within the cultural context of the spiritual traditions of that time. He totally made it all of a sudden. And, you know, he came from royalty where he would have had a lot of power. In this situation, he's in a new situation where he'd have a lot of power. He'd be leading a spiritual group. People would be looking up to him. It was a pretty good assignment. Twice he got offered this. It's kind of like if, you know, Mick Jagger or Taylor Swift asked you to get up there on stage with them, or like that, kind of like that, or partner with the Pope. Sorry, I just couldn't resist. In any case, but it's kind of like that, you know. It was a big decision, but in both cases he said no, and he returned to solitary wandering because he had a sense of what was possible. It's so amazing when you think about it. He had a sense of what was possible, even though nobody in his culture saw what he intuited was possible. So that's actually really pretty radical. He hadn't gotten there yet. He just knew that there was a kind of freedom and that this wasn't it. And that's interesting for us because, you know, in our, most of us on our spiritual journey, we have some inner sense, some compass of where we're going, but because we haven't gotten there yet, it's hard to remember, it's hard to keep track of. It's one of the tricky bits about the path. It'd be nice if we exactly knew where we were going and then we could get there, but it's not like that. So it's sort of analogous to this, and I think in a way heartening for it to know that this great being, the Buddha, was some of the time kind of flying blind, or he was aspiring to something, but he hadn't gotten there yet. No one else knew what it was he was intending toward, and he's just stepped away from these two great masters of his time. And what the Buddha said about this is, "But it occurred to me this Dhamma, what they're teaching, does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. So, just a powerful moment. It's a powerful moment. And part of what is so inspiring about the Buddha is he just kept going. He kept going. You know, I think we can transpose that to our situations. You know, bring it into your own heart and see what works. But I think we can. And I think, and I have a feeling, I probably talk about the Nibbana side of thing more than some people, because that's sort of what, I had to look at myself, that's kind of what keeps me going on the path, is really focused on that. And I know a lot of folks in this role are more about other aspects, which is great. But I think it's really important, you know, here in the West, to be able to keep focusing in that direction. And that was part of, you know, one of the takeaways, one of the reasons I went to Thailand for this pilgrimage was, and working with the two monks and some other people, I just had, we had, me and Jason Bartlett, we had great support. So we actually got doors opened and we had access to, we had conversations with five different Ajahns, some of whom are rumored to be Arhants. You know, people won't say they are. But one of them, Ajahn Ganha, was the one that really hit me in the heart, and because I got to be around him quite a bit. And I talked to one of them, I said this at the thing, but one of the German monks, there were a handful of German monks there, and one of them said he's been with him for years. He'd never seen him do anything for himself. Like, he'd never seen him do a self-involved thing. His energy was always turning out to benefit beings. And I was around him enough. We were only there 3 days. But I was kind of had that in my head because he told me right at the beginning, I was watching him. It was amazing. He just was like, just pulling people in and lighting people up. It was really something. So that's kind of where we can go. And so we can learn from the Buddha. We can learn from the Buddha. And one of the oddnesses about this time, early 21st century in the West, which is oddly parallel to the Buddha's time, is that in both cases, it was a very rich and varied spiritual kind of world that we're surrounded with in terms of variety and that he was surrounded with. It's not like, you know, America in the 50s where everyone's Christian. And it's like, okay, that's what you are. I've talked to a lot of older people, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I grew up Methodist, that's what I did. And then I went, wait a minute, I don't want to be Methodist. But in the beginning, that's what you did. In this case, I mean, here in Northwest, there's all kinds of stuff, right? There's like all kinds of churches, there's mosques, and there's all kinds of New Age spiritual stuff and meditation stuff and this kind of stuff and all kinds of choices to be made to navigate through, which can be really confusing, and you really have to like go deep and really get clear what you're trying to do to navigate that. In the Buddhist time, I mean, it's wild when you read the suttas. It was just, there was all kinds of stuff going on. The Jain tradition started at the same time that the Buddha was alive. They never met each other, but the Jain tradition started then. There's all kinds of wandering sadhus, which are like solitary mendicants in Hindu tradition. There's all kinds of Brahmins who are kind of the high end of the priestly caste in Hindu tradition. And there's all kinds of other different stuff. And so a ton of the suttas is these vigorous conversations he has with people who challenge him, who raise other points of view, almost like debates sometimes. It's pretty interesting. And so that's parallel. You know, there's choices to be made is the point. It's not just like you're in a groove and you're going to do it because that's what your parents did. It's like, this is wild and free in a certain sense here in the Northwest and very much like what the Buddha's time was. And so, and this is just, I'm going to, just from my own experience, just to share, because I've been doing this a long time. And one thing I've learned is that just because there's a high energy kind of spiritual experience, quote unquote, that's okay, but that can be so diverting. It's almost like it can be another sort of just experiencing like having a big yacht. You know, people can get super diverted by cosmic experiences, by even moments of awakening, but they didn't really go deep enough. They got stuck in the sense of the moment or the experience of it. So it's a tricky thing, and the Buddha just kept going past that. I found it really useful to kind of tune into what he was doing, because he didn't stick in the spiritual experience part. He was trying to see. And even in Kathy and I have talked about NDEs, Kathy Taylor, because it's an interest that both of us share. But you can see, talking to, and there's people who have had, you know, they died, they went out there, they contacted white light, they contacted extraordinary beings, came back, and it changed them totally. But when you read some of their lives, then it didn't mean tough stuff stopped happening. You know, a lot of them had really difficult things in their lives they had to struggle through. And often I think sometimes reading this, gosh, it'd be nice if they learned how to meditate. They sort of didn't learn that. They had this experience, but they didn't actually learn how to practice. So they're being buffeted around by all kinds of things and didn't have a way to be mindful of it and to see the component parts come apart and be aware of self and not get tugged. So I say all that because in terms of the Buddha and how he conducted this life, he was just focused on insight, on seeing, on not clinging. And it's really helpful for us as we navigate all the spiritual cornucopia around us to see what's going to be good for us. You know, what's going to ultimately help us. You know, I'm not trying to tell anybody what to do at all, but there's something to me to be learned from how the Buddha navigated this that kind of works for us too. Because he, you know, went beyond experience and concepts. He was just focusing on not clinging, just focusing on not suffering. His understanding of emptiness was underneath that. And it just drops, clinging, and there's freedom to be found. And it's harder to do if we concretize. So the Buddha just went, he's like, didn't concretize anywhere. That's what's so amazing about what he taught. And my own experience, but that part of a living a flexible spiritual life is knowing when to change direction and paying attention in our own hearts, because we're all individuals, we got our own karma, and even within the Buddhist path or, you know, whatever you are, to not get rigid. That's where people get in trouble. They get like a rigid idea. Maybe they saw something, they get a rigid idea about it and stick there. And then they're not adapting to what they need to see, because the very journey of the spiritual path, when we get more aware, when we cultivate our awareness, we also become aware of our stuff, of our sticky places, of our complications. And we have to work with that. We have to bring it in, bring our awareness to it. It may change our ideas of what we're going to do, how we're going to, the choices we make. And there's a certain kind of navigating. It's a funny story. Achan Cha, great Thai master, because he was very vivid being. And he could be like a sweet, kindly old grandfather. And then he could be incredibly fierce within nanoseconds of each other. And he'd be telling this person this and that person that. And he got people, someone protested, says, how come you tell this person to go this way, and then you tell this other person to go that way? And he said, well, if they're walking down the path and a person's starting to go off the path on the left, then I tell them to go right. If they're starting to go off the path on the right, I tell them to go left. So we have to tune in, is the point. And that's what's really interesting. I say all this because in terms of the Buddha's last 6 years before he awakened, and he kept evolving his direction and made some huge direction changes in the middle of all that. So it wasn't like just a straight line. He was trying to figure it out. And he made enormous commitments this way and that way, and then had a new understanding and shifted all in this. And that's where it's complicated, because you could, you know, people can bounce around and make different decisions because they can't make up their minds, or because they're getting jerked around by their friends or jerked around by their patterns. He was looking for awakening, and he was just navigating how to do that. And to a certain degree, even if we're all in the Dharma, to a certain degree, each one of us is doing some of that, because we're navigating our conditioning. You know, everyone's path is a little bit different. And so it's really, with that in mind, it's sort of fascinating the look at how he navigated all this. So some of you know Bodh Gaya is in Bihar State. It's where he awakened. I had the great opportunity to be there twice. And there's a place called the Dungeshwari Cave, which is in the, I'm reading here because I can't remember, Pragobi Hills. Close. Anyway, but I've been there. It's so cool. It's like, it's about 9 miles. There's a river. It goes right by Bodh Gaya, but it's this very shallow river, at least in the fall. Probably never mind soon. It's not shallow, but in the fall, it's shallow. And to get to these caves, which are over there, where you can drive about 25 miles around, or you can just walk. And so you just wade across the river and then just walk in through these. It was so amazing. It's like walking through these, not through the rice paddies, that would be uncool, but riding along the edges of the rice paddies. And it just felt like nothing had changed in 2,600 years. Out there, there were no cars. This was 1991 when I did this, but there were no cars. There was no, kind of, not much of anything. And it was little teeny huts and villages and dirt huts and people with rice paddies and stuff. And in that cave, that's where he practiced for 6 years before he became awakened. So he had a whole period after he left those teachers in the beginning. He just went and practiced by himself, and he had the five ascetics, and I'm not sure how much of which was when, but this is where he practiced, and you can go visit those caves. They're pretty cool. There's kind of temples built up around them now. But the point being, during that period, his best understanding of what to do was to practice in an extreme ascetic condition. And this is like famous. You see, once in a while you'll see statues in Asia of the Buddha with super skinny with his ribs showing. You may have seen those. This is before he was awakened statues, by definition. But in his, the way he is, he like pedaled to metal about this point too. It wasn't like half-baked asceticism. He just went for it. And so I'm going to read this slightly long passage because the imagery is so amazing. It's MN85. He says, because of eating so little, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. My limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo. My backside became like a camel's hoof. My spine stood out like a string of beads. My ribs jutted out like the rafters of an old rundown shed. The gleam of my eyes sank deep in their sockets, like the gleam of water deep in a well. My scalp shriveled and withered like a green, bitter gourd shriveled in the wind and heat. If I touched my stomach, I felt my backbone. If I touched my backbone, I felt my stomach. So thin had I become. If I defecated or urinated, I fell over on my face there. If I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hairs rotted at their roots fell from my body as I rubbed. So, kind of extreme. right on the teetering on the edge of living, actually, at that point. But he'd gotten there because he had this ferocious focus on what was possible, which I guess I'm sort of suggesting, as much as we find that in our hearts, that's good, because we're on the path, and that's, if we're going to, make it efficacious, then we need that, as much focus as we can muster or is natural for us. But he also didn't stay fixed on that idea. He got it. You know what? This isn't working. It was huge. It's an enormous thing. It's almost as huge as these great teachers saying, you be my buddy, and he went the other way. And this thing, because this was in a world of ascetics. There's still sadhus in India, who do extreme asceticism. And to turn away from that, to say, wait a minute, this isn't working. That's like really radical. So there's something to learn there. Because he was focused on the direction of awakening, and he finally came to the conclusion he needed to do something else. He needed to eat. And so he opened that up. I thought, it is not easy to attain this pleasant abiding with a body so emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some rice and porridge, and ate some solid food, some rice and porridge. Now at that time, five monks were waiting on me. These are the five ascetics, thinking, if the ascetic Gotama achieves some higher state, he will inform us. But when I ate the rice and porridge, the five monks were disgusted and left me, thinking, the ascetic Gautama lived luxuriously. He's abandoned his striving and reverted to luxury. I mean, that's not exactly luxury. That's just eating rice and porridge. But those were his best buds. And he made a choice. And, you know, I'm not going to get to it now, but if you ever read when he first goes back, the first turning of the wheel in Sarnath, they're the first people he teaches. And even though in the beginning they say, oh my God, here's that glutton, the Buddha coming, then they got it, how he'd awaken. So it's this kind of beautiful, this beautiful moment. Point being, just that he shifted. And point being, for us to pay attention to, have that focus and see what we need to do. And then there's this beautiful little thing when he basically saw the middle way, he saw the path, he remembered, I see you nodding, he remembered a moment in his childhood when his father was, it was some sort of ceremony, where his father was ceremoniously in the spring plowing a field. He wasn't really someone who's going to run down a plow, but just ceremonially. And the young Buddha was sitting under a rose apple tree and just fell into meditation and was happy and free. And he saw that. The Buddha remembered. He flashed back. I thought, I recall when my Sakyan family father was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. So there's the distinction. I entered and dwelled in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to enlightenment? Then following on that memory came the realization, this is indeed the path to enlightenment. So there's this huge shift he made. Pretty amazing. So, you know, just kind of keep our eyes opening, keep listening to people more awake than ourselves. That's what I always try to do. And listen in our hearts where we have to go. And, you know, that's part of why reading the suttas is great, because you're bringing in the words, a transmission from the Buddha. Or, you know, there's great Tibetan texts, there's different, or Zen texts, you know, whatever it is, but reading the words of the awakened ones and see how that lands. But it's so hard, you know, this can be really hard, because the places where we're blocked are indeed the very places that we need to be aware of, to be free of them. So we have to see we have to be aware of what our blocks are to get through them, which isn't so easy. And so, you know, I'm always checking in my own self and see if my blind spots are deluding me and seeing what I need to change. I mean, there's like micro decisions as we journey. And so lastly, we're almost done here. But many of you have heard of Mara, who is in a sense, the personification of distraction, kind of a semi-mythical figure, who knows, who does his absolute best, Mara does, to stop the Buddha from awakening. And there's this big metaphoric climactic, I mean, who knows, internal struggle, because the Buddha supposedly sat all night under the Bodhi tree, awakened by morning. And so during that period, he kind of came up against all his stuff. And in particular, because, you know, second noble truth is that the reason why we suffer is because of attachment and aversion, grasping and aversion. And he came up, Mara brought up to him sort of the biggest graspings and the biggest aversions that he might encounter, to see what he'd do, you know, to see if he'd buckle. And, you know, to be sure, the Buddha was a young man in his mid-30s, prime of his physicality. So on the attraction side, he sent his three undulating and voluptuous daughters, Tanha, Arati, and Naraga, to lure him away. And they danced and they spun and they tried to attract him, to get him to divert him from his goal of awakening. It didn't work. And in Samyutta Nikaya 4.2, Mara says, come now, good sir. You are handsome, youthful, and in your prime. Why struggle with meditation? You should enjoy sensual pleasures instead. And the Bodhisattva, he's not the Buddha yet, he's a Bodhisattva, replies, the chains of sensual pleasure are brittle. I see their danger. Your daughters have no power over one who has removed the roots of craving. So then Mara tries the other thing, aversion, in the form of this most terrifying army of fierce beings with fierce weapons to see if he can scare the Buddha into backing down. So he conjured a great army with soldiers wielding spears, arrows, and swords, but the weapons fell as flowers at the feet of the Blessed One. And then finally, doubt. And, you know, Tony, Mara said, "Who do you think you are, sitting here striving for enlightenment? You are alone. No one else has walked this path before you. How can you succeed?" And the Buddha responds, "Evil one, you are defeated. Your armies have been scattered. The earth itself is my witness to the deeds that brought me to this seat. With firm resolve, I shall not rise until I attain awakening." So how, you know, literally we take all this exchange, I don't know. But it's metaphorically, it's really pretty powerful. And I'm trying to remember if the Buddha, nope, it's not this Buddha. But, you know, the touching the earth thing, that's what he's talking about. So, you know, this journey isn't easy. But it's fruitful. And sometimes for each of us, you know, we can feel, I mean, I was at like these monasteries, it was like, oh, you can be totally alone here in a monastery. You know, we can be totally alone in our practice here in this crazy 21st century world, but right in the middle of a Thai monastery, you can be totally alone sometimes too. And in a sense, we're up against our stuff, even though there's brotherhood, and we're alone. It's part of the journey. It's part of the journey. And the way forward isn't always clear, but that's a time to continue, not a time to give up. And part of what we get from all this, to me, is a kind of a confidence in the possibility, in the potential, in the fact that the Buddha did awaken. Because when you read the suttas, it's just, to me, it's like incredibly clear that this was a being speaking at a whole different level. I mean, a transcendent level, not clinging anywhere, not sticking anywhere, just offering and free. So we can do that. The sutta you're referring to, which one? I've been, this last one, or someone just asked that. David. Tell you what, let me finish this, and then we'll see if you come around about that. So the Buddha awakened even though no one else had before. We have the example of an awakened being and many, many others, Padmasambhava, great awakened beings in Tibet, great awakened, you know, masters, arahants, all quite a number, many, many. So it's, we can have some confidence and keep cooking. And I think this first part of his life before he was awakened is really kind of beautiful. That's part of why there's so much emphasis on it in the suttas, because his journey is our journey in a lot of ways. And about the very end, in terms of his own statement about, there's a number of them, but he said, in terms of his awakening, he said, "This is the light that arose, the knowledge that arose, the wisdom that arose, the illumination that arose within me. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Through many a birth in samsara have I wandered, seeking the builder of this house. Painful is birth again and again. O house builder, you are seen. You will not build this house again. All your rafters are broken. The ridgepole is shattered. My mind has attained the unconditioned. I have attained the destruction of craving." Let me just sit for a moment. Oops.